Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the annual dinner of the Environmental Law Institute. We at ELI want to pay special tribute to the fact that our government is now back in operation, but a special tribute to our public employees, our government service, which we all honor. All of you here, you are now participating in the largest gathering of environmental professionals in the United States this year. But I want to start our dinner with a brief remembrance. We who have been in this practice, we who enjoy the company of others, we who have been here at other dinners honoring extraordinary individuals, we have lost one of ours in a very short time, and I want to just pay a very short tribute to somebody that we knew and loved, Francois Brehaigne. For more than 40 years, Francois helped to build environmental law. In 1997, we paid tribute to her here, along with her husband, for her service to the world in environmental gains that were done. And here is just a sentence or two in the award presentation to Francois that year. It said, the citation, together she and her husband have been instrumental in creating several of the landmark environmental law efforts of our time, such as the United Nations World Charter for Nature, the Convention of the International Trade of Endangered Species, and the Convention on Biological Diversity. We honored her in 1997. We honor her now. And a second person just within a few days ago has passed away. Many of you know him, Marvin Durning. Marvin was a Rhodes Scholar. He was a Yale Law School a graduate. President Carter appointed him as the Assistant Administrator for Enforcement. He served all 4 years of the Carter administration. He returned to Seattle, where he continued a lifelong commitment to the environment and natural resources. And again, just a few days ago, Marvin passed away. So I just want a moment of silence as we remember and recall great individuals who did so much, Francois Brehaigne and Marvin Durning. Okay, you have a great brochure in front of you, which describes in lots of detail Environmental Law Institute. We had a great year. And those signature things that we all care about, ELI ran over 80 programs last year. We're still doing boot camp. We filled a room full of 150 or so, 20-something lawyers. You would all have been thoughtful about having that much youth in one room. And so the educational program is going on. We put on new books. The Environmental Law Reporter is still the most cited environmental law reporter in the nation. And we all know the Forum Magazine is something that we treasure. But here's something else you might not know. We have now moved to almost a half of our work is international. We have somebody full-time in Malawi, Africa. We just had somebody come back from Liberia. And the team that just was in Mexico City helping the Mexican government implement their new constitutional right to water just came back a day or so, and they've arrived to be here. But probably our signature event this year was the training of 600 federal judges in Mexico City, and by enhanced learning, by distance learning throughout the country, that now brings us to over 2,000 judges in 25 different countries. We're enormously proud of the impact we've been able to have on governance across the world. And I hope those of you who were at the reception were able to go into the back and see the computer demonstration of something that we just issued the press release today. We're very proud to announce ELI's Echo Patent demonstration. 11 companies have put 100 or so patents of environmental benefit on the website, and now individuals, states, foreign governments can actually access that and use it for free. These are free patents that are all environmentally beneficial that are now available on the ELI website starting today. And of course, we're hoping to draw other corporations, hoping to draw other people into that mix. We owe a lot to Wayne Alta from IBM, who thought of that and was a moving force behind the Eco Patent Initiative. Many of you are at what we call star sponsor tables. There are 46 star sponsors. This is our highest ever, proving that the economy is not doing that bad. But we want to honor our star sponsors, and so I had a choice. I could stand up and do it, or I could have the young people of the Environmental Law Institute do it. I chose the latter. Videotape, please.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us at ELI's 29th Annual Award Dinner. We are thrilled that so many supporters could make it out tonight, and ELI would like to take a moment to extend a special thank you to the star sponsors who helped make tonight a success. American Cleaning Institute, Arnold and Porter, AstraZeneca, Ferguson and Campbell, Beverage and Diamond, Bingham McCutcheon.
For their gracious support, we recognize Bloomberg BNA, The Boeing Company, BP Corporation, Brian Cave, Covington & Burling, Crowell & Moore.
The entire staff truly appreciates the enthusiasm for ELI's work from the following star sponsors: Dentons, DuPont, Exelon Corporation, Barilla Braun & Martell, General Electric, Geosyntec Consultants.
Star sponsors, your generosity enables us to continue advancing our mission. A big thanks to Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, Holden Lovells, Holland & Knight, Hush Blackwell, Huntman Williams, and IBM.
We are so grateful for the ongoing aid of the following star sponsors: K&L Gates, Gatton Moching Rosenman, Keller & Heckman, Kilpatrick Thousen and Stockton, King and Spalding, Kirkland and Ellis.
With your assistance, we can work toward a future of progress and innovation. Latham and Watkins, Morgan, Lewis and Bacchus, National Association of Clean Water Agencies, Paul Hastings, Perkins Coie, Pfizer.
On behalf of ELI, a huge thanks goes out to Hillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, Pittman, Roger and Victoria Sant, Sidley Austin, Cy Paget and Rizal, Walmart, and West Academic Publishing.
We extend our deepest gratitude to those of you who played an essential role in tonight's success: Weyerhaeuser Company, the Wilderness Society, Wilmer Cutler Pickering Hale and Dorr, and Winston and Strong.
From all of us at ELI, thank you for your support.
So the last speaker there was a 20-something Kristen Lockhart. It was, she put the whole thing together. But the middle speaker was our newest hire, Alejandra Braza, who's actually a Mexican attorney, and she's been leading our Mexican judicial training effort. So you're getting to see the people behind us in environmental law. You're getting to see the people of environmental Law Institute, and they were the ones who volunteered to be here tonight, who greeted you, who are watching you, and many of them will be visiting your table. You are, of course, this audience and a group of very extraordinary individuals who have dedicated your lives to advancing the environment in a number of different ways and a number of different professions. The Environmental Law Institute, of course, has as our vision making the government work, to, in fact, have a country that we all can trust, and, in fact, natural resources that we all treasure, and an environment that we advance. Those are behind the values of the Environmental Law Institute, but behind them are an extraordinary group of people, some of whom you saw on the video, but we also have a wonderful group that is our board of directors, and it gives me a great deal of pleasure now to introduce the chair of our board. Edward Strobain has had an extraordinary career.
Peter Clapper.
That's good. He was one of the co-founders of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He was the executive director of the Council on Environmental Quality to the president. He's been a director of ELI in the last several years. He's been our chair. He was a clerk to Chief Justice Earl Warren in 2011. He was elected as a fellow to the American College of Environmental Lawyers. In October 2010, Ed, along with three other law school classmates, received the highest Yale Award for his work in setting up NRDC. And this year, along with two others, he received the Burton Award as the 2013 Distinguished Legal Writing. He's a great man, a great leader, and a great friend, and it gives me a lot of pleasure to bring to the podium Ed Strobain. Ed.
Thank you, John, for your generous remarks. Too kind, too nice, but more importantly, thank you for your superb leadership of ELI. What a wonderful gathering. This is just record setting. You guys, for your involvement in ELI, we really appreciate. Your contributions are tremendously important to ELI, and for that, you make a difference. Just as ELI makes a difference, making it all work for people, places, and the planet. I had the great good fortune to work with our distinguished board members, almost all of whom are here tonight. Thank you. I can't say enough about ELI's outstanding staff. Your innovative research, your influential programs, your expert reports, and all the work you do every day makes a difference. It makes ELI the excellent organization that it is. I thank you. I'm honored tonight to introduce Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. I will not be as funny as she will. She will in turn introduce the two remarkable individuals who will receive the ELI 2013 Environmental Achievement Award, George P. Schultz, Thomas F. Steyer. Both have distinguished themselves for their extraordinary work in advancing clean energy and reducing climate change. Senator Klobuchar is the first woman to be elected to the United States Senate from Minnesota. This path-breaking achievement was presaged by her early accomplishments. After receiving her Bachelor of Arts degree in Political Science from Yale University, magna cum laude, and her law degree from the University of Chicago Law School, she practiced law in Minneapolis, becoming a partner in two of Minneapolis's leading law firms. She was then elected county prosecutor for Hennepin County, which includes Minneapolis and 45 suburbs. In 2006, she was elected to the United States Senate with 58% of the vote. In 2012, she was reelected with 65% of the vote. Her career in the Senate is marked by early and continued leadership of initiatives that would advance clean, renewable energy and address climate change. In June of 2007, only a few months after she was sworn in, she introduced her first major initiative, the Klobuchar Snow-Bingaman Amendment to the Energy Bill of 2007. This carbon counter amendment would have established the first national greenhouse gas registry. In addition, she joined a bipartisan group of senators that struck a key deal to raise the corporate average fuel economy standards for cars, trucks, and SUVs by 10 miles per gallon over 10 years. In April to June of 2008, the Senate was considering the Lieberman-Warner climate change bill that would establish a national cap and trade program to reduce CO2 emissions. She authored with Senator Snow the bill's first title, to establish a national greenhouse gas registry, a bipartisan effort typical of Senator Klobuchar's leadership. Thus, in the past few weeks, Senator Klobuchar was one of the bipartisan group of 14 senators, led by Senator Collins, that worked hard to craft a bipartisan solution to the end of government shutdown. Each week during the debate on the Lieberman-Warner bill, Senator Klobuchar gave a major floor speech addressing the benefits and goals of the bill. Here's an example. We need a bold energy policy. We need to increase vehicle fuel efficiency, make a national commitment to generate electricity from renewables, and invest research in cutting-edge technologies for alternative fuels and renewable energy sources. This is what we need to do. In February 2012, speaking on the Senate floor, in support of extending tax incentives that helped develop the next generation of biofuels and renewable energy, Senator Klobuchar concluded, "What we need now is a comprehensive national blueprint for energy policy in this country, a solution that preserves the integrity of our air, our water, and natural resources, that gives businesses the incentives to research and develop new sources of energy that invest in the next generation of American innovation. This is our challenge." You can't get more clear-cut than that. This is what we need to do. This is our challenge. Who better to introduce our annual award honorees than Senator Amy Klobuchar?
Thank you so much, Ed, and thank you. I think you may know that we had a break for the week for the Senate, and I just want to thank your group for bringing me back to Washington, because I hadn't had enough of it for 3 weeks. So thank you so much, but I wouldn't have missed it. I want to thank all of you in the audience today, and I'm honored to be here with such an outstanding group to present the ELI's prestigious 2013 Environmental Achievement Award, and to give you a few words first about what's been going on in Washington, or what hasn't been going on, and actually to try to give you some hope for the future. You first need to know that I didn't grow up with Washington politics. I came from Minnesota, where, in the words of our pseudo-poet laureate Garrison Keillor, the women are strong, right? The men are good-looking, and all the environmental lawyers are above average. But in fact, my only job in Washington, and my first job, was as an intern for Vice President Mondale, where they had me crawl around, very glamorous. When I was in college, I crawled around under the desk and wrote down all the serial numbers of his entire staff. But what I like to tell young people, that was my first job in Washington, and this was my second. So do well on your internships. And then actually my only official visit to Washington before I came to the Senate was when I was the elected prosecutor in Hennepin County, and I still remember I got to go when Bill Clinton introduced the hate crimes bill and had this big event at the White House, and somehow at the last minute I got to introduce him because of some work I'd done in the topic, and I was standing outside of the East Room and had never even been in the White House, not even on a tour. And the band was there, and they played that Hail to the Chief, you know, da, 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 da. And I just start walking in to where I'm supposed to go on the stage, and all of a sudden I feel this big hand on my shoulder, and this voice says, "I know you're going to do great out there, but when they play that song, I usually go first." That was true. That was my first official visit to Washington, D.C. So then I came to the Senate in 2006, ready to get things done. And actually, we worked really hard. I was in that group with Ted Kennedy that tried to get the first immigration bill done, and I feel really good about what the Senate did just now, the last few months. But it's been not the easiest time to be in Washington. And I'm someone, my Republican friends here know, who always tries to work across the aisle. Two-thirds of the bills that I have led have been with Republicans. But I was not quite prepared for what we saw in the past month. People who were denying that we even had to pay our bills, people who were using this government shutdown, it appeared at first for a partisan poison pill of messaging. And I think in the end, there was chaos, but in the end, there may be opportunity. Part of it, was the 14 of us in the Senate that came together under Susan Collins' leadership. Six Democrats, one independent, seven Republicans. Is that someone from Maine? Very good. While in the end, Senator Reid, Senator McConnell negotiated the final deal, a lot of the elements that we talked about in that group, and clearly those were seven Republicans they needed to get it done, were in the final agreement. You may have heard that half of the people in that group were women. I would note that we now have 20 women in the Senate. We're very good friends. I just had them all over to a Minnesota potluck dinner at my apartment a few weeks ago. But every single woman in the Senate voted for that compromise, just to give you a sense of the women. This is our record point, not our high water mark. I did notice, and I noted in a tweet a few months ago, that for the first time in the history of the United States of America, we actually had a traffic jam in the women's senator's bathroom. So this is a sea change, and I think you're going to see more of that leadership in the months to come with Patty Murray heading up the Budget Committee in the Senate and Barbara Mikulski heading up the Appropriations Committee. I personally think it makes a difference. So what did this agreement do? Well, it bought us some time to negotiate something a little more substantive as we look at the sequestration cuts coming up in mid-January. And a lot of people say, oh, you kicked the can down the road. But I'm not sure people realize that if we just kicked the can down the road for a year, those sequestration cuts would take effect, which are, of course, on 20% of the budget. 70% of the debt reduction we've done so far, $2.4 trillion, is in the cut area, where most of the, even most conservative debt commissions have come out and said it should be about a 2-to-1 ratio, 3-to-1 ratio. And so we have an opportunity now by having this deadline of January 15th of actually looking for some reform to some of the government programs, to look at some potential loopholes, revenue, so we can have a more balanced approach going forward on the budget. So it was not the easiest time. I will say it was better than New Year's Eve. That was my personal low point, where there you are, you know, midnight, and I turn to my left and I see Harry Reid, and turn to my right and see Mitch McConnell, every girl's dream, the stroke of midnight. And I thought that moment was going to be the low point, but no, we had the last month. Now, let me just tell you some of the reasons I think we can come out of this, and I'm going to get to the environmental and energy repercussions of this as well, and why I think there may be some opportunities here. First of all, you have, for the first time, in a very big, explosive way, some of the moderate Republicans and others in the Republican Party that have been willing to speak out. You have the chamber talking about challenging some of the Tea Party people. You have people taking on people like Ted Cruz. I noted at the gridiron speech I gave a few months ago that in this town, when we hear about a bad Cruz, we don't know if it's Carnival or Ted. We have, okay, that's the only really political joke I'm going to make, okay? So just like deal with it. I'm sorry, Texans, sorry. The truth is, when you look at what happened here, you had John McCain on TV calling this the height of foolishness. You had Karl Rove commissioning a poll showing that 58% of independents thought that you shouldn't shut down the government over the Affordable Care Act. You know something's up when that is going on. The palpable anger of the American citizens can be felt not only in these public opinion polls. There's another one came out today, but I don't think you need a poll to hear what I hear when I was out in Fargo this morning with Senator Hoeven. When you hear citizens just say, we're so glad you guys are doing an event on the farm bill together, thank you. Or you hear people at a food bank in Minneapolis saying, look, we have people that don't have enough food, that are hungry, why can't you get your act together? People are just sick and tired of members of Congress who are standing in the opposite corners of the boxing ring throwing punches. And I would say this is especially true in my state, where we are down to 5.1% unemployment. We have a record exports. They really feel that we're on the cusp of economic opportunity, particularly in the energy area. And one of the only things that's holding us back, that's doing the things that we need to do about climate change, doing the things we need to do about energy, is an intransigent group, people that don't want to compromise. This red light, green light game that we play with our tax code, that just is no way to encourage business investment. But as I mentioned, in the mess can come opportunity. Opportunity to do something more with the long-term budget. Suddenly, the Farm Bill, which, as you know, contains some good conservation measures supported by nearly every conservation group in the country, $24 billion in debt reduction over the current Farm Bill because of the fact that we went away from the direct agriculture subsidies to crop insurance. Immigration bill, $160 billion in debt reduction in 10 years, right? So we're just going to pass that up? It doesn't make any sense at all. Suddenly, these things have a little bit more reason to resonate in the minds of more moderate Republicans and the people of this country. The Shaheen-Portman energy bill, right? We had to stop that about a month ago. But these are all things that can lead to good results for our country. And I truly believe that courage in the next few months and really the next 2 years is not going to be about standing by yourself in the Senate for 21 hours and giving a speech in an empty chamber about green eggs and ham. Courage is going to be instead whether or not you're willing to stand next to someone you don't always agree with for the betterment of this country. And that is the hope that I have for this Congress. Now, when it comes to energy and environmental policy, I think you've seen this gridlock before. Many of you in this room say, yeah, well, what we saw in the last few weeks, we've been seeing forever, even for the simplest changes to environmental policy. As was mentioned, I worked early on in Kent Conrad's group, the bipartisan energy group. We were stymied in our efforts, and I think our nation has had many missed opportunities in the last decade or so. I'd say, I'll point to a few of them, bipartisan in my approach. The first would be immediately after 9/11, certainly invading Afghanistan and combating terrorism were the top priorities. But I still believe in my heart of hearts that if President Bush had seized that moment and with the American people behind him and stood up and said, you know what, we need to make our nation truly independent from the countries involved and made a new case for American energy policy, I truly believe that 80% of the people would have said, sign me up. Okay. That didn't happen. We're not clapping because it didn't happen. The second moment was more of Congress's fault. It was during the summer of 2008. I was there on the floor. We did take action, as was mentioned, to raise gas mileage standards. By the way, that's a moment I'll never forget, that press conference. One of the more senior members of the Senate was there. And I stood up and I said, this is so great to be involved in this effort. It was my first press conference. I said, we haven't raised the gas mileage standard since I was in junior high. And the next member stood up and said, I was here when that happened. Okay, so I'm not doing that again. But so we did do something back at that time. And we also made energy efficiency improvements for consumer goods. You remember that? Policies that I like to call building a fridge to the next century. But it's hard to make environmental jokes, you know. So, but we didn't make the same kind of progress on a comprehensive energy and environment plan like we should have at that time. And I still remember we were one vote short of beating the filibuster on a national renewable energy standard. Third moment was when President Obama first came into office. I remember he met with the Democrats. He wanted to move forward immediately on a renewable energy standard then. As I mentioned, we had been only one vote short in the past. And for some reason, the decision was made not to do that. I actually think that it would have had wings. We would have been able to get that done. I think a decision might have been made that we should do something bigger, which was right. But unfortunately, all the eggs went into that basket. And while I supported, as was noted, cap and trade, given the state of the economy at that time, and given the resistance we encountered, it didn't pass. I also like to always think of the name. I think everyone thought it was okay because my friend Senator McCain supported it when he was running for president. But that name, cap and trade, I'm telling you, I'd be in parades in northern Minnesota and people would yell, no on trade, no on caps. Like it didn't really resonate with people at all. And as I think as we look forward, we have to look less inside the bubble of Washington and what appeals to people when you want to make environmental policy and more outside. We know we all have challenges ahead. Look at the stories today about the smog in northern China, where they've literally had to cancel all their flights, where people can't even get on public transportation, where they've had a 30% increase in visits to the emergency room, where my friend here at my table, from the Dan from the Health Effects Institute, said they only have 200 people in their equivalent of the EPA. We have challenges internationally, and we have challenges here. But let me just give you some hope of how I think we have a roadmap of doing something pragmatic to get our country to where we need to be. My first reason to be optimistic is Gina McCarthy at the EPA. I think that Lisa Jackson, I will note, did a fine job as EPA secretary, and now in the second administration, we have Gina, and I think you look at her background working with Republican governors, her reputation among business leaders as being tough but fair, and her experience navigating the ways of Washington make her well-suited to look at some of these bigger picture issues. As someone who comes from the ag state, I know that the EPA can get bogged down in small controversies that may take away from a larger mission. And so I first noted that the rollout that she did of the new greenhouse gas standards for new coal plants, I think it was well done. I think the way she approached the existing plants and said she was going to look at it for this year was also smart. And so I'm feeling good about the work she can do. Secondly, a thing that I think is happening right now is a realistic approach to Congress. The Washington Post this past Sunday ran an editorial where they wrote, "The overriding problem is that Congress hasn't faced up to the global warming threat. Instead of updating clean air rules and building a policy that addresses the unique challenges of greenhouse gas emissions, it has left the EPA and the courts with a strong but sometimes ambiguous law that applies imperfectly to greenhouse emissions." All true. It's all true. So what do we do when it comes to Congress and environmental policy for people that want to see some progress in the next year and a half? I know that my friends in the environmental community have been understandably frustrated by inaction on climate change. I've been frustrated too. But given the current mix, I'd argue that this is a time to rebuild and to make some friends, and in particular, to make some friends on the moderate Republican side of the aisle, and to not ask for perfection from every member of Congress. I would focus, as many are doing now, on some of the efforts going on in the Senate. By the way, it's the Senate that has passed the transportation bill, passed the farm bill, the Senate that I predict will pass the Shaheen-Portman bill. Which, as you know, contains a range of policies that would reduce residential, commercial, and industrial energy use. It has the backing of the Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the National Wildlife Federation, to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the National Association of Manufacturers. Another example, the Farm Bill, with the conservation efforts in that bill. This leads to my third reason for hope, and that is that there are a lot of businesses out there that have realized that they can't afford the pure cost of the old way of doing things. More and more businesses are seeing the good in going green, whether it's Walmart and its huge push toward energy efficiency, or companies like Whole Foods and IKEA that are equipping their roofs with solar panels. Target, that's my hometown company, so I couldn't do Walmart and not do Target. Using LED lights equipped with motion detectors so their freezer cases light up only when a customer is nearby. Apple, working toward a goal of getting 100% of its energy from renewables. Unilever, adopting the sustainable food production practices of Ben & Jerry's ice cream when it bought the company in 2000. And it's encouraging also to see a group of more than 100 large companies, including several in my state, Cargill, General Mills, Best Buy, 3M, all in my state, come together. We are second per capita for Fortune 500 companies. The first is Connecticut, and they're like the size of an iceberg. So, but these companies have come together to create the sustainability consortium to improve the sustainability of their supply chains. Along those same lines, we're going to hear tonight from our honoree about what they've done in California to make and partner with business and government. Again, all giving me hope. Fourth reason to be positive is that there are some current economic policies, both on the federal and state level, that are working and that are moving us in the right direction, as well as market changes. I've been frustrated, as I mentioned, by our inability to move forward on federal legislation. But what we have done is done a great job of actually reducing our dependence on foreign oil. Between 05 and 12, it has dropped from 60% to 40%. And just yesterday, the Energy Information Administration released its annual report on U.S. energy-related carbon emissions and found that in 2012, these carbon emissions fell to their lowest level since 1994. These achievements are thanks to a combination of many factors. The gas mileage standards I mentioned, the work, biofuels work, the cleaner fuels, the use of natural gas. I was just out with Senator Hoeven looking at what they're doing there. and not just to quote the Washington Post, the Fargo Forum today, which I woke up reading, has an interesting editorial on flaring and the work that has to be done there, not only for the economy but the environment, as they look at increasing their natural gas extraction and what has to be done to better contain that. Other thing that's worked is the state experiments. We're going to hear about California right now. Minnesota has a 25% by 2025 standard. Xcel, our largest energy company, electricity company, held to a 30% standard. They are on track to do it. This was a bill signed by a Democratic legislature and our then governor, Republican Tim Pawlenty. So this can work. It was Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis who said that the states are the laboratories of democracy. And we've certainly seen that right now with our energy and environmental policy. But the problem is that you need a functioning national democracy to have the states be truly the laboratories of democracy. So I am hopeful that once we get to this point of compromise that I truly believe in my heart we're going to get to, that the states will be, again, useful models in the environmental and energy areas for how we can get this done. So that leads me to our award winners tonight, because they are all about how we can get this done. These two men understand that, yes, this is about environmental and energy policy, but it's also about jobs, it's about economic growth, and it's about national security. In the effort to combat global climate change and bring new energy solutions to our country, few people have fought as tirelessly and passionately as Tom Steyer and former Secretary of State George Shultz. Working together, they led a dynamic coalition of business, labor, environmental, and community groups to defeat a California ballot proposition to repeal AB 32, which is California's Global Warming Solution Act, the most significant state program to reduce CO2 emissions and reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. Thanks to Shultz and Steyer's work, AB 32 was soundly defeated by California voters. And the coalition that they founded, Californians for Clean Energy and Jobs, is now helping to lead the way in the promotion of renewable energy jobs, projects, and businesses in California and around the nation. In addition to their work as a team, Shultz and Steyer are both incredibly accomplished leaders. As Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, Secretary Shultz helped secure the Montreal Ozone Protocol. While serving in the Nixon and Ford administrations, he helped create the Environmental Protection Agency and played a key role in developing U.S. energy policy during the OPEC oil embargo. Still going strong at the age of 93. Sounds pretty good, huh? Secretary Shultz chairs the Hoover Institution Shultz-Stevenson's Task Force on Energy Policy, as well as the advisory boards of the Stanford Precourt Institute for Energy and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Energy Initiative. Our other honoree tonight, Tom Steyer, founded the global equity management firm Farallon Capital Management with his wife, Kat Taylor. He and his wife also created the Tomcat Center for Sustainable Energy and the Steyer-Taylor Center for Energy and Finance, both at Stanford University. Tom established the Yale University Energy Sciences Institute to conduct cutting-edge research on clean energy and the environment. Notably, Tom has given the Giving Pledge, a promise to donate the majority of his wealth to charitable nonprofit purposes. A major part of his pledge has gone to address global climate change. Individually, both Tom and Secretary Shultz have been forces for good in this country. But tonight, we celebrate their unique partnership, a bipartisan effort to advance the environment. They are shining examples of what individuals of differing backgrounds, parties, and generations can do if they work together for the common good. I'm therefore honored to present ELI's prestigious 2013 Environmental Achievement Award to Tom Steyer and George Shultz. Thank you for your outstanding joint contribution to environmental law policy and management. And we have a special treat for you. Although Secretary Shultz could not be here today, he has given us a great gift. ELI President John Cruden and board member Jose Allen traveled to Stanford and videotaped a conversation with this extraordinary man. The entire conversation lasts an hour. I thought I would pause then. No, okay. But it will be posted on the ELI website. Right now, we have a short excerpt of John's conversation with the secretary, which we will show you now before Tom comes to the podium. Thank you.
Well, I have a long history. When I was Secretary of Labor in 1969, suddenly I find myself a chairman of a cabinet task force on the oil import control system. President Eisenhower thought that if we imported more than 20% of the oil we used, we were asking for trouble in national security terms. And that was obviously getting pushed. So this cabinet task force was formed, and I was the chairman. And we put out a really good report, published. And we said, the problem is really tensions in the Arab-Israeli situation, where a lot of the oil comes from. That's what we had to worry about. So we ought to try to import less oil from there, more from Canada. And let's see if we can't save a little bit. And also, let's have some storage in the ground and so on. Well, everybody, President patted me on the head, said, nice report. We're at a congressional hearing. Nobody did anything. A little while later, I'm director of the Office of Management and Budget, and President Nixon creates the EPA. On a broad base, I think there was broad support for what he was doing. It wasn't like he was trying to get around Congress. But at any rate, when a new agency is formed, they get money from other places and space and so on, and they don't exist. So if you're not careful, they're going to get all the dogs. So the director of OMB becomes their representative. And actually, we're pretty good representatives, because the OMB knows where the bodies are buried. Nobody wants to mess around with us too much, because we got too much to do. So we created the EPA, and some of the people who were involved had served on as staff in that task force that I had been on, and they were very environmentally oriented young people, bright, able. So I sort of got a little interest. So that's some of the early things. And then, of course, a few years later, I'm Secretary of the Treasury, and what happens? The Arab oil boycott, just as we had said, this is likely. And so I could see the national security aspects of energy. I could see the economic aspects of energy. And I had earlier been exposed to the notions of the environmental aspects of energy. And something else impressed me. There was no energy department, so the Treasury was the energy department. People would come in, and they had ideas about alternatives and saving energy and all kinds of things. And I thought they were interesting, and I tried to do what I could to encourage it. But a few years later, the oil prices go down, the crisis has passed, and all that stops. People lose interest. In the 80s, there got to be a growing number of scientists who said that the ozone layer was depleting. And there were doubters, there was debate, but I would say the bulk of them thought it was depleting. But they all agreed that if it happened, it would be a catastrophe. Nobody doubted that. And I was working with them, and our State Department people had a strong role in this. We had a very good EPA person involved. And we had good science, I thought. And I had twice a week private meetings with President Reagan. And so we talked about it. And he thought, and I thought, you know, we better take out an insurance policy. And as it turned out, it worked. But as also as it turned out, the people who were worried were right. And the Montreal Protocol probably came along just in time. Arnold Schwarzenegger called me, he was the governor, about this Proposition 23 that two dirty Texas oil companies put on our ballot in California. and asked me to co-chair an effort to defeat it. And I was in favor of defeating it, so I said yes. I said, who's my co-chair going to be? He said, well, we think it'd be good to have a Republican and a Democrat. I said, yeah, I think that's a good idea. So a man named Tom Steyer, who I didn't know, I knew of him a little. So I went up and we clicked. But I remember in our first meeting, we said, look, we don't want to just beat this thing. We want to beat the hell out of it. Because the way you really make a point is you have a large victory, a clear mandate from California. We went about it carefully. We got both candidates for governor of California, Republican and Democrat, to be on our side, Meg Whitman and Jerry Brown. We got a lot of business support. We got union support. In other words, we had a coalition of people that was very broad-based. And we said, this is not about politics, this is about solving a problem. And so it was problem-centered. And actually, when the votes were in, we won by the biggest margin of anything on the ballot.
But that's not the way you started out, correct? I believe in the beginning.
We started out, but we put on a hell of a campaign. There's another thing about what Tom and I did. We had a good time. I find the work on solar energy is very important and making huge headway. Actually, I have solar panels on my house on the Stanford campus. I've had them there about 6 years. And I have a little graph that shows my electricity bill before and after. And now the amount of money I've saved pays for the cost of the installation plus the opportunity cost of the money. Well, I'm driving a little electric car around, so I figure I'm driving on sunshine and it's free. Let's put all forms of energy on a level playing field. Why shouldn't every form of energy bear its full cost and compete fairly then with other forms of energy? And to do that, they should bear the cost of the pollution that they create, the carbon. So I propose a revenue-neutral carbon tax. I make it revenue-neutral so it's not a drag on the economy. It's not a means for raising money. It's for the sole purpose of leveling the playing field. We've had big problems before. We solved them. We've always done it. And we were talking about Ronald Reagan. You know, when he learned that he had Alzheimer's disease, it was about 10 years before he died, he wrote all of us, his beloved American people, he wrote us a long letter, you may remember it, in his own handwriting. And the last two sentences of the letter were, I now begin the journey into the sunset of my life. But for America, I know, there will always be a bright dawn ahead. So I'm with him. There is a bright dawn ahead.
Okay, Eli, that was like the best video I've ever seen, so. I will say that I think we all want to be like that when we're 93. But now it is our great honor to have Tom Steyer come to the stage and accept the award on behalf of both yourself and Secretary Schultz. John Cruden and Edward Strobain will also join me to present the award and read the citation.
I will read briefly from the citation. This one is to Tom Steyer. We have a second one for George Shultz. Working together across party lines, Tom Steyer and George Shultz provided an outstanding example of innovative leadership to advance clean energy and to help overcome the challenges of global climate change. We celebrate their individual commitment to the best technical and policy thinking on new livable energy systems, and we applaud their remarkable joint success in forming and leading a coalition to keep the California dream of a better future alive.
Yeah.
I want to thank Senator Klobuchar, and I want to thank ELI. Let me say this. I absolutely love brilliant, tough women from Minnesota. My mother happened to be a brilliant, tough woman from Minnesota, and my grandmother happened to be a brilliant, tough woman from Minnesota. But unlike them, I got a chance to go on Senator Klobuchar's web page and to see exactly what she stands for, and she stands for everything that I believe in about energy, right from the local level to the global level. So I think she should be very nervous about the kind of groupie that's forming on the stage here. And I also want to say thank you very much to ELI. I spent some time going through to understand exactly what the people in this room do. It overlaps incredibly well with what I've been doing, what I've been doing with George, and some other things that we've been working on together, which I want to talk about a little bit tonight. But the approach is incredibly similar, the values are incredibly similar, and the mission is incredibly similar. So I want to say to you, thank you for what you do. It's nice that you gave George and me this award, but I'm much happier to thank you for what you do on an ongoing basis, and which I consider to be of vital importance. And let me also say this. I understand where I sit in this partnership. I see myself as part of the greatest slugging brothers in history, which were the Aaron brothers, Hank Aaron, and his brother Tommy Aaron, who between them hit 768 home runs. I'm very proud of that number, 768. Hank hit 755. Tommy hit 13. You can guess which one I am. And let me say this, I think you guys got just a touch of how terrific George Shultz really is. Just a touch. I have had a chance to work with him over the last 3 or 4 years, and he is absolutely as sharp as a tack. He is an incredibly good person with incredibly good values. He is absolutely fun as hell. And he is just a great person to work with. I mean, at the last party we had, George stood up after dinner to sing a song. So he really is. We have a rule in California, which we're going to try and I'll try and live up to tonight, which is everything that we do has got to be fun and productive. If it's not fun, you're not going to keep doing it. And if it's not productive, there's no reason to do it. So that has been the motto of our partnership. Everything we do has got to be both. Let's see if I can carry that out. I will say this. People think that George and I are really different. So let me go through the differences. We're from different parties. We're from different generations. And we really have one thing that might surprise you. We have very, very different sets of friends. Even though he and I are very good friends and he has an absolutely spectacular wife. On the night that George went to Ronald Reagan's 100th birthday party with a group of his best friends. My wife and I were at a hip-hop party in Oakland celebrating solar energy. I couldn't really see myself at the Reagan 100th birthday, to be honest, and I certainly couldn't see George and Charlotte at the hip-hop party over in Oakland. But the truth of the matter is that George and I have an amazing amount of the same values. We really aren't different in any of the big things. You know, we really view the values that we're fighting for in the series of things that we've done, which really started but certainly didn't end with the No on 23 campaign. We really have three things that we think we stand for. One is we really stand for the democratic process. We want to win this through votes. We really believe in the American people and that we can win when we have this conversation openly in an intelligent way. The second thing is we both really believe that the private enterprise system, given the right incentives, given the right framework, is the answer to this problem. Neither of us is in the position of trying to blame private enterprise. In fact, we think that will be the solution once the policies are in place. And lastly, we have a very exciting idea together, which he mentioned, which is we have the thrilling idea that full cost accounting is the thing that will make a huge difference. And without teasing, we really believe that. It's a simple idea, the polluter pays. It's not more complicated than that, and that's exactly what George was talking about. It isn't about raising revenue, it isn't about anything else. It's about having a level playing field where the polluter pays for their pollution. If we can do that, we really believe that will unshackle the innovation, the research, the incredible changes that the American private enterprise can come up with. So I would remind you, very briefly, to contrast the energy industry with the communications industry, where in 1983, when I was coming out of business school, they were just breaking up AT&T. In 1996, they deregulated communications. In 1983, I remember my family was certainly still using a rotary phone. There had been really nothing that had changed. And today, the big news is the Twitter IPO. But getting from my family's rotary phone to the Twitter IPO is 10,000 innovations. That is what the American private enterprise system can do under the right circumstances. That's what it's fully capable of doing. That's exactly how we're going to solve this problem. But the big question that I would like to address tonight, coming from our experience in California, is so what? What is there that really is transferable? Why does it really matter? What are the lessons? So let me say this. We in California are very proud of the concept that we lead the nation. We're extremely proud. We are the first state to really go bankrupt. We're the first state, you may remember, which I thought was a terrific innovation, to pay in scrip because we had no money. We're the first state where the legislature had less than a 15% approval rating. Very proud of that. We really know how to do it right. So we had, George and I not only did the No on 23 campaign, in 2012, we ran another proposition, which was a yes proposition, which was changing the way out-of-state companies paid state income tax because there was a loophole that saved them over $1 billion a year. It's a very complicated prop. We used half the money to retrofit schools for energy and use the savings to make the schools better. So we had two completely different propositions. We had one that was a defense of a very broad energy bill. We had one that was a complicated yes. We had one that was the most highly talked about proposition in an off-year election, one which was way down ballot. It was Prop 39. I mean, think about that, Prop 39. There were a few other things on the ballot, including the president. But the conclusions of how we won were exactly the same, and I actually think, from what we can tell in the stuff that we've done outside California, that they resonate across the country. The first thing that we did was, George talked about coalition, and I want to talk about that last. But the first thing we did was we had a completely different message from the traditional environmental message. And the traditional environmental message has to do with the environment. Unfortunately, in California, when there was a proposition, when there was an election that contrasted environmental values with jobs, environmental values lost. So the first, we had three messages. One was jobs, why the new energy economy was going to create more jobs than existed. And that was something that we had business people talk about. Secondly, health. We felt that the way that people actually respond to pollution is through health, particularly of their kids. And a lot of the greenhouse gases go out with other kinds of pollution that actually cause asthma. So people actually relate to that because they can see it, they can think about it, it's something they can conceptualize. And the third one is, sometimes Americans believe that companies aren't going to do the right thing in order to make money. And when there's an honest-to-God instance of it, they will react to it. Those were the only three messages we used. We didn't talk about the overriding parts about global warming, about greenhouse gases, because we thought we really needed to talk about what people could understand and relate to, not what we cared about. So the first thing was message, second was messenger. We felt when we talked about health, we had the American Lung Association talk about it, because the American Lung Association is all about health. And when they talk about it, people believe it. When business people talk about jobs, people believe that they're responsible for jobs and therefore they'll listen to them. So we had a different message, we had different messengers, and George touched on coalition, but in my mind, he didn't get a chance to go as deeply into it as I know he understands it, which is this. It is true that we made sure that we had a really strong business voice. It is true that we had a very good relationship with organized labor. In 2012, in conjunction with organized labor, we knocked on 5 million doors. So if you're going to be Prop 39 and you want to pass a complicated measure that no one knows anything about, knocking on 5 million doors a few times is actually a pretty good way to pass it. But the last thing is this, and I know most of you know this, but I feel as if it's almost my ethical responsibility to make this statement almost every time I talk about this, which is this. The number one group in California that routinely votes 20% ahead of the rest of the state for environmental issues is Latinos. Number two group, Asian Americans. Number three group, African Americans. So if you want to do something that deals with the environment and you really think that your coalition doesn't include most of the people in the state of California, I think you're kidding yourself. So if you really want to pass something, you have to go out to the people who will vote to you for you. And that is something that we made a huge point about that was different from the previous propositions and that people don't normally expect. So that may be the model that works for California propositions. But as June Carter says in the movie Walk the Line, "You've got me out on stage, Mr. Cash. Is that where your plan ends?" So I want to talk a couple, maybe our plan goes a little further. I want to talk you guys through a couple other things we're doing. One is we 2.5 years ago, George and I were two of the three founding board members of a business voice around the country. It's called the Advanced Energy Economy. The idea is business, we cannot win this fight without a strong business voice. We cannot win this fight if people believe we're job killers. We cannot win this fight unless we're local and granular, state by state. And in fact, we believe that that is the only way we really can build a broad-based coalition on this. And if you look in 2013, the attempt to roll back RPS and energy efficiency standards across the country, if you check, has gone absolutely nowhere. And it's been the kind of thing that we're doing with a whole bunch of other people, but that AEEE has been part of a coalition that has meant we've not lost any of these. And we strongly believe, we think that's where it's coming. We think that kind of gritty, state-by-state involvement where you get into the details, God is in the details for a lot of these things. But we really feel as if that is something that is important. And you know, we've seen it when I've gone to different parts of the country, the clean energy companies are desperate to put themselves together into a voice. It's really important that that voice exists and the companies know it, and a lot of them are not huge companies and don't have the ability to have government relations, so someone has to do it. This is a nonpartisan thing. It changes the dialogue away from jobs versus the environment. It's something that fits in exactly what ELI is doing. Let me see, the other thing that we're doing that along these lines is we started something called Risky Business. And that is basically a study to make the rational case for understanding climate risk as an economic phenomenon. The idea is that if we do nothing, what is the cost of that? That the actual decision to do nothing is a decision, is a choice. We feel as if the status quo is where we are, but actually choosing the status quo is a decision, and in my opinion, an absolutely disastrous decision. But we're going to go through the group of people who came, hatched up this idea. Hank Paulson, Republican, former Treasury Secretary, Mike Bloomberg, independent mayor of New York, and me. So you can see, I am very good at picking partners. I mean, I'm like one of the great doubles players in tennis. But once again, and let me say this, that George is on the advisory committee. You know, we think that this is important to lay to rest the idea that this is jobs versus the environment. We want to have a bunch of absolutely credible people talking about what it means economically to do nothing on climate. So in this regard, in regards to Risky Business, my first ask of you people tonight is to support me in the Tom Cruise role. I think it's me, to be honest. So I want to talk a little bit about, let me just conclude by saying this. when people talked about why the 2010 bill failed in the Senate, there's a long, I think it's 85 pages or 115 pages by a Harvard researcher named Theda Skocpol. And she said basically there wasn't a broad-based support for it on a local level in the United States of America. That basically when people went home to their districts, they weren't hearing from their constituents that this is something that people actually cared about. And when you think about what that means, if you look at the polling, and I'm pretty obsessive about reading polls, 70% of Americans think that we're right about this, which is a very high number. But it's not that relevant a number, actually, politically. Because if 70% of the people agree with you, but they don't care about it very much, that is not going to change anybody's vote. The only time it really affects elected officials is when people care about it passionately, when that's the thing they live for. And when you think about the great changes in American politics, there are people who I would think of as identity warriors. They're not wondering if the issue is about them. The issue is their identity. And they may disagree with you about everything else, but that is the overriding issue for them, and that's actually what has to happen here. Now, there are only two things that can happen here, in my opinion. Either 97% of the scientists are wrong, or we're going to win. Those are the only two possibilities in my mind. And let me say this. I think people get discouraged about this. I am not remotely discouraged about this. You know, I remember the quote from Hemingway about how you go bankrupt. And they said in one of his novels, how did you go bankrupt? And the man said, I went bankrupt two ways, very slowly and then all at once. That is actually how we're going to win. We're going to win very slowly and then all at once. But we're going to do it with a much broader coalition than people expect or believe in. We're going to do it basically by making this the most important issue for the American people. And let me say this. I quit my job at the end of last year to do this. I had a great job, which I liked a lot, which I'd done for 30 years where I was grossly overpaid, which is a wonderful thing in and of itself. But I believe that for every generation, there is one big challenge. And I think this is the big challenge. I think that when people look back, this will be the thing that determines whether we are successful or not. This, you know, you go back through American history and remember what the different generations, how they measured themselves, how they measured each other, and how we measured them. And there'll always be one thing that is so much more. I always tease and say, do you remember where your family stood on the great tariff debate of 1873? Nobody knows whether there was a great tariff debate of 1873. There may have been, for all I know. But the fact of the matter is, 13 years before, there was something that everybody remembers. And so the vision of ELI, a healthy environment, prosperous economies, and vibrant communities founded on the rule of law. That's the vision of ELI. So what you're doing really matters. What is going on, I think people tend to think of themselves as being less important than they really are. And I think they tend to think of themselves as having less impact than they can really have. But as George Shultz likes to say, democracy is not a spectator sport. You know, when I was growing up in New York, the greatest team for us was the Yankees, and the greatest player on that team was Mickey Mantle. And Mickey Mantle was from a family in Oklahoma, and they were all coal miners and had been coal miners for 100 years. And nobody in the Mantle family ever lived to be 40 years old because they were all breathing coal dust, and they die at 36 to 38. So Mickey Mantle was pretty much of a fall-down drunk. You know, he figured, like all the other Mantles, he didn't know anything about coal dust. He just figured Mantles died early. So he didn't take care of himself, and his career ended a lot sooner than it could have. And when he was 54 years old, Mickey Mantle said, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. And that's, he didn't value his own behavior. Here was this guy who actually threw away an amazing talent and an amazing opportunity. By contrast, I would give you George Shultz. He's 93 years old. He gets up every day and works on this. He is, you know, he's an amazing example for all of us. He's a wonderful guy. He's a great partner. But I think if he's willing at 93 to get up and push himself and keep going, then I don't think we can do anything less. Thank you very much.
So Tom, when the Environmental Law Institute announced the award, the immediate feedback we got from numerous people is, what an odd couple. And here is my answer. My answer would be what Senator Amy Klobuchar said today, different parties, different generations, different backgrounds, coming together for the common good, making things happen, focusing on solutions, taking diverse people, putting them together. There's lessons for all of us today. And I want to say to you and my thanks to make you remember just for a minute how you saw the tape of Secretary Shultz at the end. What you could not see is he was answering questions. The question I asked him at the end was, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic about the future of the country? Remember what he did. He looked back and he recalled the handwritten letter that he received from Ronald Reagan when Reagan knew he had Alzheimer's. He knew he had it, and notwithstanding that, he is writing the letter to his friends, and remember, he quotes from memory the last two sentences of that letter where he says, I'm now starting the journey into the sunset of my life, but for America, a bright dawn ahead. And if we have a bright dawn, it's because of the people in this audience. There are over 700 of you all who every day are trying to make a difference. But today you heard from leaders, Amy Klobuchar, Tom Steyer, George Shultz, who are all making a difference for all of you, Senator, Tom, and from a distance, in Stanford, California, George Shultz, we're proud to be associated with you, and we look forward to that bright dawn that Ronald Reagan talked about. Ladies and gentlemen, this was the Environmental Law Dinner. It's done. You're over. Stay with your friends. Go to the bar. Celebrate the environment. God bless you all.